Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Emporia. My returning guest tonight is Donald Kruidsma, world-renowned authority on birdsong and professor emeritus of ornithology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And we're talking about his book, Birdsong for the Curious Naturalist, Your Guide to Listening. Don, welcome back to the show after too long an absence. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Mark, always good fun.
This is an interesting book because it's a book that actually gets you to do things, hopefully. It's a book for all ages. And as usual, it not only does it get you to listen to birdsong more carefully and critically, but it gets you to actually sort of be an amateur scientist.
It does. You know, Mark, I go all the way back 50-some years to college, and the most exciting course I took was not in my line of main interest, but it was genetics. And the exciting thing, well, back then we didn't know much about genetics, but the most exciting thing about that course was what we did not know, and that was half of the course, charting the course into the future. And it's the same with birdsong. There is so much we don't know, and anyone can just go out and start listening, and you practically become a world expert on any chosen topic that you choose to listen.
Now, let me give the layout for the listeners who haven't probably picked up this book yet. First of all, there's 734 recordings associated with this book. That's 75 plus hours of listening. Now, you can access this listening two ways. How can you access the listening?
Oh, you can go to the website, birdsongforthecurious.com. It's a free website. Everything's there, and you can download all the sounds.
Oh, man.
Anybody can contact me and download them all with a single click. But you can also access them through these QR codes, these quick response codes right in the book, holding up a smartphone, aiming it at that little QR code, and like magic, you're transported to the Internet. And there are all the sounds at a click.
You got hooked on those during your last book because I thought they were incredibly effective. You wrote a beautiful book about biking across America with your son, and what was amazing for the reader is you had these quick codes while you're listening to the songs. You could listen along with you, and that was a fantastic experience.
Oh yes, ride right along with us. Hear the birds as we hear them. Hear the local dialects of not only birds but people as we cross the Appalachians.
That was great.
Yeah.
What's amazing about these recordings, and as soon as I started getting into them on the website, I ended up just getting drenched in the recordings. I just wanted to keep listening to them. These aren't short little recordings. These are long, luxurious, sumptuous recordings of these species.
Oh, yes. You know, as a scientist, I started out a half century ago asking how an individual Buick's wren gets its song. And it's that focus on individuals that I realized that I've kept throughout my life. So, you know, Brown Thrasher sings. Well, here is a Brown Thrasher singing. Let's listen to him for a few hours and see what we can learn. It's focusing. I guess the bottom line for this book, Mark, is if you know how to listen, every singing bird becomes interesting. Every robin, every individual.
I want to thank you for getting me to closely listen to robins, and now I find robin songs some of the most complicated songs I've ever listened to.
Robins are neat.
Yeah, robins, they really are.
There's so many ways, so many levels at which you can listen to a robin.
I also have an anecdote about you.
Oh.
During the Breeding Bird Atlas 2, Sheila and I were deep in Quabbin just before dawn, and we're listening, you know, we're ticking out birds and stuff like that, and all of a sudden you just like walked out of a bush, as you are wont to do, and you said, "Have you heard that veery?" And meaning a singular veery, and you went on and on about how you were the specific song of that veery. And I think a lot of people don't realize that there are differences from one individual to the next. And it becomes very important regionally. There are a lot of regional dialects, too.
Oh, yes. If you get to know individuals, you can hear so much individuality in birdsong. Chipping sparrows. There's so many varieties of chipping sparrow songs. And it's because partly because they learn them, partly because there's some improvising going on.
Yeah.
And then, of course, these regional dialects with songs varying from place to place, that's all heaped on top of the individual variation. And then you get into learning, and they're learning these dialects. It's cultural transmission. It's oral traditions. It's, and then given their learning abilities and all these brain centers, why they can develop these monstrous repertoires, too.
It's amazing. By the way, just as an aside, do you want to, like, lobby to change the name of the Chipping Sparrow to Cemetery Sparrow? Because I think that's a more appropriate name. I don't know a cemetery, I think, in New England that doesn't have a chipping sparrow, or many.
That's true. And golf courses, too.
Golf courses
are great.
All this that we're talking about is in this book, and there's so much fascinating information. Now, I want to go back to your very beginning, because you thank Olin Sol Pettengill Jr. to set you off down this road. How did that happen?
Oh, Mark, I was a chemist in college.
Oh, come on.
No, I was a chemist, and my last semester I discovered birds.
Thank God.
And I had to catch up on my birds, so that summer after I graduated, I took the beginning and advanced ornithology courses simultaneously at the University of Michigan Field Station, and Pettengill, the master Pettengill, was the teacher. And so I had a $100 fellowship I had to work off, and he said, here, take this parabola, this big Nagra reel-to-reel tape recorder, go record some birds, and we'll call it even. Wow, I did not realize where that little event was taking me, but it's been a glorious 50 years since.
Let's talk about the difference between songs and calls. Is there a clear difference?
Only in the minds of insistent birders and ornithologists. The birds do not have such a clear distinction. We humans need to pigeonhole things, and it's just not that clear sometimes. But most of the times, here in the north temperate zone, it's mostly the males who do this thing we call singing. You know, they rise to the treetops. They do something often long and complex, and as soon as they're paired with a female, they do a lot less singing. So, and then there are these call notes that are much simpler, like the chickadee-dee-dee of the chickadee, and calls that are used in specific contexts to warn of danger or to say, you know, I'm hungry, says the baby. So they're, you know, for most birds, we are comfortable saying, oh, that's a song and that's a call, but it's pretty muddy because we even have songbirds that we cannot think of a song for, like a cedar waxwing.
I was going to ask you, because that's a section in this book. Cedar waxwings, what is that? Is that a call note that they're doing?
Well,
they have different ones, too. They have different kinds, but it's not really a song.
They really have two extremes, a kind of a buzzy note and a pure tone note, and they give them in certain contexts, the pure tone note loud just before they're flying, and there's a gradient between the two, and they're using their two voices to produce that little buzzy note as they bounce back and forth between a low and a high note. But is there a song? How do we define a song? Does it have to be vocal? Could it be the beauty of the wax on the wings? And you know, so we can define songs functionally. Don't necessarily have to be vocal. One could say, well, the songs have to be controlled by those song control centers up in the brain. And if they're not controlled by those song control centers, why, then maybe they're controlled by some non-learning part of the brain, and then we label them calls. It's getting complicated. We'll leave it at that.
But there's a great section in this book, female songs and duets. And I think a lot of people don't realize that there are such things.
Yes, and the north temperate zone here, you know, breeding has to be a very hasty business. The males come back typically early. They sing. The females come. They quickly lay the eggs, and then they got to get out of here before winter again. But in some species, especially a resident bird like a cardinal, or if you go to the tropics, a lot of females sing. But for there are a few species up here where we say yes, absolutely, the female sings. To listen to a female cardinal. This time of year, in fact, if you're out listening and you say, there's a cardinal, you better look at it, because it could be the brownish female or it could be the red male. And she sings from the nest, too, just beautifully and just as finely as does the male. So, yeah, there are a few species where the female does it all.
I was just a couple of days ago out in Worthington watching a pair of sandhill cranes, and they both started trumpeting and making complex songs. And that's one of the – that's in your book, by the way. I just read that section of the book, and it was as if it was coming alive right in front of me.
Mark, put the headphones on, the stereo headphones. This crane experience was the ultimate. They're about 70 yards away across a frozen lake, and – the male and female are flying around left and right. You close your eyes, you can just feel the movement.
Yeah.
And then what birders often do, some ethical issues involved here, is they play a song to a male to get him really excited, and he sings a lot. I had a natural playback of this kind. A female intruded into this pair's territory, and wow, all hell broke loose. The female chased this. The resident female chased that female, but you can hear this female approaching, and then the reactions of the adult male and female who own that territory. Yeah, the sandhill cranes are spectacular.
Now, there's also birds without a song, and I love this section. And you have Canada goose and chimney swift as two of the examples, as other examples. But Is that just not a song because it's not complicated or pleasing to our ears in the same way? Because Canada geese make a variety of vocalizations. They have complex vocalizations. Chimney swifts, first of all, I love the sound of chimney swifts.
Mm-hmm.
And but is it just that we're not calling it a song for weird anthropomorphic reasons or what?
I think you hit it. You hit it squarely there. A lot of these things, you know, we listen to, well, first off, they're not true songbirds. You know, the true songbirds are the ones, the little dicky birds that learn their songs.
Passerines.
Well, among the passerines are non-true songbirds, too, because those flycatchers. It's messy. And as to what is a song or a call in some of these other birds that are not passerines, why, you know, it's almost anybody's guess. One could argue one way or another, and then really you want to know the function. What's the function of a song and the songbird that we know?
That gets more to it. That's right.
Yeah, so now you're back to what's the function of these things that the geese are doing, and a woodcock flying up there in the sky. Well, that's certainly a song. He uses his wings and his voice.
Yep. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch, my returning guest tonight. It is always a pleasure to talk to him. Donald Kreutzba, world-renowned authority on birdsong and professor emeritus of ornithology at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And we're talking about his book, and I think it's one of his best books ever, Birdsong for the Curious Naturalist, Your Guide to Listening. Now, there's a whole – I wanted to talk about these sections in depth. Under some of these – there's what's called an explore section. Talk to me about what those are. And there's another 48 of them, by the way. There's 48 of them in the book and another 29 on the website. What are they encouraging the reader to do?
Oh, the first sentence in the book, Mark, let's see if I remember. It's bird song fills our lives with beauty and wonder. And yeah, there's the beauty, but for me, the wonder drives this book. You know, what is it all about? What can I hear if I go out and listen? This time of year, white-breasted nuthatchers are doing a lot of singing.
Mm.
Well, you can say there's a white-breasted nuthatch, and then somebody way back when, some ornithologist has said, well, these birds have two different songs, a fast-paced one and a slow-paced one. But nobody's ever really listened to them to see how the birds use the slow-paced one and the fast-paced one. And I encourage readers to just start counting something. I like a quote somebody told me once, science is the art of collecting interesting numbers. Well, count something. Collect some numbers. And before you know it, you start asking questions that you never would have thought of before. And so these are journeys of self-discovery that I like to take readers on. I say, did you hear that? Well, what if you listened a little bit more? What if you found something that in that bird's song that you know you'd recognize if you heard it again sometime? I call it a handle. Get a handle on that bird's song, and then you start listening for where that handle occurs again, in a robin, for example. And you start to hear patterns that you never would have heard before. So it's these explore sections that take me back to my genetics course in college that try to emphasize, you know, what we don't know, and you, the reader, can participate in this, in these journeys of learning.
This reminds me of another thing. I was leading a bird trip for Mass Audubon Worcester, and we were at the along the river, and we kept hearing a perfect white-throated sparrow song, and I'm going, geez, this is midsummer. They shouldn't be here in southern Worcester County. And it was a chipping sparrow singing a pure white-throated sparrow song. And I remember falling into exactly that. Like, I wanted to sit there. Unfortunately, I had a trip I was leading, and just listen to it and record it and ask that question. Like, why is it doing that?
Why? Do you have witnesses for this, Mark?
Pardon?
Do you have witnesses for this?
Yeah, I actually do. the entire class was there, and they were all fooled too. And I was like, "Where's a white-throated sparrow? Let's find it." Because, you know, I was all excited about it, that we might have a breeding white-throated sparrow in June along the Blackstone National Corridor. And it turned out it was a chipping sparrow. And I remember everybody in the class was like looking at each other, going, "Like what?"
Like, well, here's part of the wonder of bird song. These songbirds learn their songs. Chipping sparrows. I love going through cemeteries, golf courses, and listening to pairs of chipping sparrows because each individual chipping sparrow learns his song from one neighbor. So you often have just two birds with, you know, a miniature dialect. You can hear the matching between the two. So a chipping sparrow singing, that's just so off-key. But those brains are capable of learning of, well, in this case, mimicking, you know, a white-throated sparrow. This doesn't happen by chance. So, you know, was the bird paired? did he find a female who could, a female who could actually pair with him? All kinds of questions.
And even if you don't have an answer, just searching for an answer is worthwhile.
Oh, absolutely. You know, all the big questions about bird song, like why do songbirds learn their song? Why, we have no answers.
Well, my big one is, why do they sing first thing in the morning when they've got to be really hungry?
Oh, yes. And some smart ornithologist would say something like, well, they're showing how well they can sing on an empty stomach.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay.
And the reason we don't know much about the dawn chorus, why most of us don't like to be up at that time of day.
I think it's the best time of day, especially as we're going into this season. As you write, I love what you call winter, the big silence in the book. Although there is song that happens in winter, but
yes,
now we're going into the big singing event. And speaking of which, there's something you do in this book that just tickled me. You really, in the music to our ears section, you really talk about the music in birdsong as a music person would, with the accelerando, and you talk about the crescendo, and you have examples of each.
Yes, what can I say? It's beauty. It's just stunning. And we can find examples of everything we call music in birdsong. It's beautiful.
Well, that brings me back to another Don Kreutzmann story. The first time that we met down here, you came down and we were playing bird songs. And this is a story I tell to other people. It was the first time I actually saw somebody literally wax rapturous. And there was no other term for it as you were listening to the bird song. You really listened to it as if you were listening to a beautiful aria or a symphony or any other kind of a great audio art. And it really, that changed my entire way that I listened to music right there.
Well, this has grown on me for 50 years, and it just keeps getting better. And last summer, I think, was my most intense. I was out every every dawn I had remote recorders and microphones capturing sounds in a dozen places around New England. And I promised myself over the winter, I got to slow down a little. I can't do this every morning. It's just so disruptive. But the dawn chorus is so extraordinary. I was just thumbing through my book, and I came across the dawn chorus section. And then there's a page that says, oh, by the way, this is the dawn choruses are throughout this book, and there's a whole list of all the dawn choruses you can listen to in a whole variety of species.
Well, you have something called the Big Listen.
The Big Listen. Oh, this is probably this. I can't remember exactly where this is, but this must refer to something like a brown thrasher.
Well, I think it was more like a big sit, except. Oh. For people just – you also wrote, don't get so bent out of shape if you can't identify the species right away. Mm-hmm. Just listen to the song and enjoy it.
Yes. Most of us want to put a name on something.
Yeah.
And almost by putting a name on it, we feel like we understand it, and then we miss what the thing is, what the named thing is really doing. So, there's a wonderful book title. I don't have it right in the mind, but if we're truly listening to something, like we don't care what the name of the thing is, but that's not quite true, because we want to know the evolutionary context. We want to know the relationship of this thing we're listening to other things that we've listened to, and try to understand, what's happened over evolutionary time. But true, just listening without worrying about naming. I tell people, pull up a chair, pull up a chair, close your eyes, and just concentrate on everything you hear around you.
This gets back to the aesthetics of the bird song, to don't be afraid to appreciate it like you would any other piece of music.
Absolutely. And you have to realize that our ears are not up to
speed. Right.
Because what the birds are doing, it's been shown that birds can hear in time far better than we can. They have what we call a better temporal resolving power. All that means is that for us to hear the details that the birds hear, we have to slow those songs way down 4 times, 8 times. And by the time we get there, we can hear some of the most spectacular things. And it is things that sound percussive to our ears, like the last half of a wood thrush song.
Yeah.
They don't sound that pleasant to our ears. There's some percussiveness and dissonance there. But wow, slow them down to the pace where our ears can appreciate what the birds no doubt are hearing, and it is truly mind-blowing. You hear those two voices working together. Sometimes, thankfully, birds sing slowly enough that we can follow along with the details and appreciate it, but you got to know there's just so much more there that we can't hear.
Finally, we just have a few minutes left, and we could talk about this book for days. There's author's choice at the end, and I love that, because as soon as I read that, I decided I was going to make my own list. But it was fascinating. First of all, it's like whenever you wrote that, that was your list, because on another week or another month, it might be it's something totally different.
Yes. People sometimes ask me, what's your favorite bird?
Oh, God.
Favorite bird song. And somewhat flippantly, I say, well, it's whatever I'm listening to at the moment. And there's some truth to that.
Yeah.
But then there are some things that, author's choice. There are so many. My son asked me, we were biking across the country, Virginia to Oregon. We got to Chief Joseph Pass in Idaho. And he finally asked me, he says, well, how can all birds be the most spectacular? I said, it's just the way it is. No other explanation needed. And so there were a few birds that were kind of left over at the end, and I said, holy smokes, I can't leave those out. They're just experiences to be cherished here. And so, I put a few author's choices in there, and I ended with the bird that taught me so much as a graduate student, the Buick's Wren. And the dawn chorus is out in Joshua Tree National Park.
I'm glad you included Common Loon and Winter Wren, because those are two of my favorites.
How could I not?
Winter Wren, for me, I mean, I realized when I made my list, it was also about how I experienced them. In other words, where am I that I'm listening to them? So in Winter Wren, I'm in a northern forest, often fairly wet, and often a place where there's not a lot of people, and it's the kind of deep forest I really, really love. And then that complicated song just comes out of this tiny little bird. It's just absolutely amazing. I was just listening to one yesterday, and I thought of this book. It's incredible. And the day before that, I was listening to Common Loons out at Wachusett Reservoir, starting to beef up their vocal stuff. And it was amazing. It was really incredible.
In the Winter Wren, thankfully, the song is slow enough that we can follow along with those little bite-sized musical tones.
But it seems to, as you get older, you lose parts of it.
Yes, but the Pacific Wren, you know, used to be just the western subspecies of the Winter Wren. The Pacific Wren has a far more intense and complex song and a much larger repertoire, but it's too fast for our ears, and so we can't appreciate it as well.
So how do we hear it when it's too fast for ears? It just blurs?
Yes, it's kind of blurry. The tones just kind of, well, it just sounds kind of, blurry. That's a good description.
Well, if you've been listening and now your interest is piqued, please pick up this book. My returning guest tonight is Donald Kreutzma, world-renowned authority of bird song and professor emeritus of ornithology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And we've been talking about his book. It's so much fun, and it's just, you can just blank out. It's one of those perfect books for staying at home because we have to, and then just cranking the songs up in stereo. It's beautiful. Bird Song for the Curious Naturalist, Your Guide to Listening. Don, it's a pleasure as always.
Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.